Ready?
Our evening began in Peter Sechelle's comfortable study in his New York townhouse.
No sleep till
Brooklyn! Yeah! Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, is that in? From the Battery to the top of Manhattan.
Yo, rope!
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jim Shear, and welcome to the Brouhaha. And we've got a very special episode today because joining us right now from Beaver County, Pennsylvania, author Dan Leroy, and you may know him because he wrote Paul's Boutique from the 33 and a Third Continuum book series, and of course, its sequel, For Whom the Cowbell Tolls. Dan Leroy, welcome to the Brouhaha.
Jim, thank you for having me be a part of this. It's a great thrill, a pleasure, an honor, all of the above.
And for years, I've been waiting to say this. Yo, Leroy!
I would have been here just to give you the opportunity to do that. That makes it all worthwhile, no matter what happens next.
Every time. The thing is, I say every time I read the book, because I've read the Paul's Boutique 33 and a Third book probably four or five times. I go back to it every couple years. Sometimes I read it twice a year. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
That's an amazing compliment. Thank you.
Yeah, so every time I read it and I see your name on the front, I say, Dan Leroy, Dan, Dan. And then I continue to sing Hold It Now, Hit It. So let's go in chronological order. Starting with your Beastie Boy fandom, I'm assuming you're a Beastie Boys fan.
That is correct.
Okay.
And it would really, I think it would be a hell of a letdown if it turned out I did this for, you know, some purely academic purpose. But yes, I'm a fan. I lost friends over License to Ill. Because I took it very seriously, and a lot of other people that I was friends with at the time, you know, didn't take it that seriously. I thought it was fantastic, and, you know, you quickly find out who your real friends are. So, yeah, I was hooked probably even before that, from the time of She's On It.
Wow.
You know, when they opened for Madonna and 1985. I did not see that tour, but I just figured these guys, they got to be doing something right. And turned out they were.
Do you remember the first time you heard the Beastie Boys? Did someone bring a tape into school? Did you see them on MTV?
No, you know what happened? I think I did see them on MTV. I think I have this memory that they played the video for She's On It.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, you know, this would have been 85 probably. And I was a big hip-hop fan before then. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that at that time in hip-hop, there weren't a lot of white artists,
mm-hmm.
and you know, this is pre Vanilla Ice, obviously. So to see three white MCs who I thought were doing it the right way. I mean, it was a pretty huge moment,
mm-hmm.
I think. And you know, I was 16 or 17 years old, and you know, these guys were speaking my language at the time. They appeared to be living the kind of lifestyle that I aspired to as a 16 or 17-year-old. And, you know, they went out on tour with Madonna, you know, ages ago when Madonna was Madonna before she became Madonna today. you know, that's... So, yeah, it spoke to me, for sure.
Because at the time, I guess, you guys were only a couple years apart. You and the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. That's the other thing is to see these guys who are really just a year or two older than you and doing what they were doing. It really, I guess, you can look at that two ways. You can look at it as these bastards. We're probably the same age, and these guys are living the kind of life that I can only dream of. Or you can look at it the way I think I looked at it, which is, hey, you know, if it could happen to these guys.
Right.
And so, yeah, I definitely, you know, was inspired. And then License to Ill came out the next year in 86. And I remember buying the tape the day it came out. I had a friend visiting me at college at the time, and I played the whole thing on one of those auto reverse cassette decks that just, you know, looped and looped. And after maybe the second or third pass, the guy was like, yeah, I just don't get it. And it was a guy that I was really close with, and it really, you know, one of those moments where you say, okay, we're friends, but maybe we're never really going to be...
Yeah,
friends.
No, I hear you. That's why when you have friends that do like the Beastie Boys, it makes that friendship even more special.
I agree.
Now, you were born in West Virginia.
Correct.
Which means the closest big city was probably Pittsburgh.
Absolutely.
And you can feel my pain on this. The Beastie Boys... I think they played Pittsburgh once, and it was in Burgettstown. So technically, it wasn't even in Pittsburgh.
Was that the, are we talking the 94 show?
Lollapalooza.
I was there. Yeah.
I was there too.
Yeah.
Now, were you in the seats? Were you in the seats? Were you in the lawn?
I was in the seats. And yeah, that was the reason I came in 94 was to see the Beastie Boys. In fact, Smashing Pumpkins, as you probably recall, were the de facto headliner. And
right.
I stayed for three songs of that. Like, I saw what I came to see. But yeah, I didn't realize that was the only show. I knew they were here, and I was here, and I was going to be there, and I was, and so were you. And
so was that the first time you saw the Beastie Boys?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, nice. I saw them a couple weeks prior in Columbus. I made a special road trip to see them on Lollapalooza, and well, that was actually the first time I saw them. After the set, I couldn't stay for Smashing Pumpkins. And then in Pittsburgh, I thought, you know what? I like the Smashing Pumpkins. I'm going to stay for their set. And like you, I could only stay for three or four songs. I needed to run back to my car and listen to the Beastie Boys.
Yeah. I mean, it was, well, all of those shows, I think, you know, it's all about the sequencing. I saw Nick Cave do a set at noon, high noon, dying out there.
Yes.
Like, of all the guys who shouldn't play a set at noon, to, you know, like 20 fans. But yeah, that, and I think Luscious Jackson.
Luscious Jackson was there on the side stage.
Yeah. And, you know, it was all about the Beastie Boys. You know, George Clinton, too. That was cool. But, but I was mostly there for the Beasties, for sure.
And how about that set? I think from 92 to 95 was the prime time to see the Beastie Boys live. Although they were great during Two of the Five Boroughs era. I loved seeing the shows then, but the energy of those shows was just off the charts.
Well, 94 was the right time because that was the point, I think, at which the world had caught up with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they made three records, and each one was really way out in front of its time. And then, you know, Ill Communication, by that point, everyone was ready for it. They caught up.
Mm-hmm.
It went to number one, and you know, they were really riding that wave in the summer of 94. So I agree, it really was, you know, the best moment of synchronicity between the band and audience.
So Dan, let's go back 5 years. This is where the story begins. Paul's Boutique comes out. My friends in high school hated it. They told me not to get it. They said, it's not that good. So where do you fall on the release of Paul's Boutique? You wrote two books about it.
I did. And again, this would really, maybe it would make a better story if I said that I was one of those guys who also hated it when it came out, and then over the years I slowly, you know, grew to appreciate it, as you know, I've heard the story many times. Now, you know, when it came out, I loved it.
And
I really, I liked it even better than License to Ill, but I got to say, the reason that I liked it better was because really, musically, I was just more into what Matt Dyke and Mike Simpson and John King were doing. Not that I don't love what, you know, Rick Rubin did, that's iconic on License to Ill, but I was just more into the sampling stuff. And I remember seeing a video for, I think the first video I saw was actually for Shake Your Rump.
Okay.
And I got to say, like, I wasn't a real savvy music fan at the time. I didn't really know that the record was coming out. I didn't have my ear to the ground. I did what I guess a lot of people did then. I watched MTV and saw the videos. Like, oh, they got a record coming out. And, man, I was into it. I just was trying to figure out where all this music was coming from, where these samples were originating. And yeah, so I was kind of hooked from the get-go, but I definitely talked to a lot of people who were like, yeah, this sucks. This is not License to Ill. And obviously, in the short term, those guys won the day.
Yeah, you know, can I go on the record with you here on the Brouhaha? The first time I heard Paul's Boutique, I loved it.
See?
When Shake Your Rump comes on, are you kidding me?
I know.
I'm like, damn, man, what were my friends talking about? This is amazing.
Well, it just shows that Pittsburgh is the seat of a lot of things, of culture, of taste, of savoir-faire. And, you know, what you just said, I think, really, really makes the point better than anything.
They needed to do one of those radio shows in Pittsburgh. It would have turned out totally different.
There is a historical what if. Just leaves you wondering.
So can we go?
Yeah.
Can we go into the whole process of the book right now?
Yeah.
When did it come to you? When were you inspired to write the book? Had you read any of the 33 and a third books? How did this
come about?
Okay.
So this is. This is 2004, I guess, and 33 and a third is a thing, but it's not the thing then, I guess, that it became. So, you know, I had read a couple of the books. I read the book on the Kinks, on the Village Green Preservation Society. I loved it. You know, I thought what probably most people think on seeing the series, wow, what a great idea. I would love to write a book on a particular album. And I remember pitching the guy who was the editor, the founder and editor of the series, Dr. David Barker.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I'm interested, and I think if I remember this right, I think I gave him three albums that I would be interested in writing about.
And those were?
Paul's Boutique was one. It seems to me that the other two were Takes a Nation of Millions, A Public Enemy, and the first Run DMC record.
Yeah.
And you know, he wrote back and said, well, look, if you're gonna go with one of these, I think we might be most interested in Paul's boutique, and it, you know, turns out that that was the right decision on a number of levels. So I put the pitch together, and they did accept it. And I got to say that it was pure dumb luck that it worked out this way. I quickly found out that it was the best choice I could have made, because, you know, one of the things that made me interested in doing it was I realized, like, hey, I was really like this record, but I knew nothing about it. And I realized that the reason I knew nothing about it was that there was really nothing written about it, at least compared to a big album of its time like that. They didn't do a lot of press.
Mm-hmm.
There were only a few interviews out there. No one had really talked to the guys behind the album, the Dust Brothers, and certainly not Matt Dyke, who'd kind of gone MIA shortly thereafter. So, you know, that was all stuff that I didn't find out until after agreeing to do the book. So, you know, that old thing, it's better to be lucky than good, because it really turned out to be the perfect project for those reasons.
So what year did you start your research for the book?
That would have been early in 2005. I spent most of that year researching and writing the book. And, you know, it quickly became apparent that the thing that maybe would give me a chance to really do this the right way would be to talk to Matt Dyke, because he hadn't talked to anyone. He had really, not long after Paul's Boutique came out, he had really, you know, not only stopped doing interviews, but really had stopped working in large part.
Now, why is that? Do you know?
Yeah, I do know. You know, there's a quote in the book from a guy named Eric Hayes, who's a graphic artist and a friend of the band, and he mm-hmm. said, if I remember this right, all Matt ever wanted to do was make $1 million making music so he could stay home and take drugs. And, you know, to some extent, that's what happened. You know, so I went looking for him through all the usual channels, and, you know, everybody told me, yeah, you're wasting your time. He's not going to talk to you. He hasn't talked to anybody, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm an old newspaper guy, so that just makes me want to dig in and, you know, try even harder. So months and months and months passed, and, you know, after exhausting what I thought was every possible avenue, I finally found a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend.
Wow.
Who called me one morning and said, hey, listen, if you want to talk to him, call this number in 10 minutes. You know, it was like total Mission Impossible stuff. And then the phone will blow up after you after you talk to him. But, you know, I called, and he was there, and we talked, and we actually talked for a long time, and then talked several times subsequent to that. And, you know, what a pleasure. Like, the guy is one of the smartest, funniest, just most brilliant people in the music business I think I've ever met. And it's very easy to imagine how a guy like that would have had the vision, assisted certainly by the other guys involved. But it's easy to imagine him having that vision for this record.
Oh, yeah. Now, reading the book, and I think it might have been brought up in the first or second one, you made an analogy that Matt Dyke either wanted to be or was sort of the West Coast Rick Rubin.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. I think Matt would, I can't remember whether he ever said that, but I think he would agree with it. You know, he definitely saw what Rick Rubin was doing with the Beasties on Def Jam. Definitely had his own spin on that. And, you know, pretty much from a comparatively early stage, realized, and I think Matt was the one who realized that, hey, there's trouble between these guys and their label, and this is a project that maybe I could get. And I think that's all Matt Dyke. That's all his initiative in talking the other guys involved and saying, hey, this is a project we can get. We ought to do this. And, of course, he did, and they did. And
because wouldn't he, he would play all of the Primo beats or his favorite records when the Beastie Boys were around. Almost like an old school episode of the Brady Bunch when Peter Brady dates a girl and he's like, I got to get the right music on. And then the Beastie Boys heard like, ooh, what is this?
Ooh, that's a nice reference. Now you wish I would have used that in the book because I remember exactly the one that you're talking about. But yeah, that is, that's kind of how the pursuit boiled down. You know, those guys came over and he was ready to play them the stuff that he and John King and Mike Simpson had been working on, and they heard it, and you know, they had the reaction like you just described, and those guys knew they had the goods, and they had the confidence that they, like a lot of people think, I think, hey, if somebody, the right person hears this,
mm-hmm.
all they're going to have to hear is 30 seconds,
yeah,
and it's going to be a done deal, and it turned out they were absolutely right. That's exactly how it happened.
And then how was it talking to the Dust Brothers?
You know, those guys, and I think this comes out more in the new book. I enjoyed talking to all three of those guys because they're all brilliant guys. They're all guys who really, you can legitimately say, changed music. There's a lot of stuff that I think happened, when the label that Matt Dyke had with Mike Ross, Delicious Vinyl, you know, when things went bad there, I think things also went bad in that partnership.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are some definite hard feelings between those guys today. That didn't come through, I think, as much in the 33 and the third book, but I think it definitely comes through in the new book, and that's partly a result of talking to Mike and John again, and you know, hearing from them that they really feel like, hey, we and Yauch pretty much did. I think the quote is 85% of the work on this record. Yeah, Matt was a conceptualist, but mm-hmm. when it came down to actually like doing the grunt work in the studio, yeah, that's kind of. That was us.
So,
and
now, did the Dust Brothers know that you spoke and found Matt Dyke?
Yes, they did.
And what was their impression?
You know, their take on it, I think, was first of all, like almost all the other people who were ever close to him, I don't think they'd spoken to him in years and years and years either. So I think there was some initial surprise. I didn't think that guy would ever talk to anybody publicly again.
Wow.
But then, you know, it's the old story in the music business about credit and who gets credit for what.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a tough thing to assign. It's not always the kind of thing we can sit down and accurately say, this guy did 20% and he did 13 and he,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people's memories are made a little bit hazier by, you know, whatever substances happen to be on hand at the time. And certainly for this record, it's not a big secret. There were plenty of substances on hand, and And so the credit issue is a thorny issue, and I think it's still kind of a sore spot. Certainly, I think for Mike and John, I think they feel like they really never did get the credit that they were due. And
yeah, just from reading different stories throughout the years, what's your take on how the Dust Brothers look at Paul's Boutique? Because it almost seems at times they want to, they're like, it seems like they can't be completely happy with it because people, the Beastie Boys are geniuses, and maybe in the back of their minds they think, well, we're the geniuses. So talking with them, how do you think they feel about Paul's Boutique 25 years later?
I think there's a couple of layers to that. One of them, you know, is the credit issue. And both of those guys were clear in this latest round of interviews that they believe that it was the two of them and Yauch who did the majority of the work, and that all the other guys, and that would be the other two Beasties and Matt, and even, I guess, Mario to some extent, like, you know, those players were peripheral, and the three of them kind of had the vision for the record and then executed it. So that's one part of it. The other layer of it is, you know, they went on to make a record with Beck that a lot of people see as kind of the logical successor to Paul's Boutique. That's Odelay. Mm-hmm. And then they went on to do some other stuff, which was very high profile stuff. You know, they worked on Rolling Stones record. Mm-hmm. They produced Hanson and had a lot of success there. I don't know. I think it's 25 years later when you look back and I think most people would say, well, there's your career. And I think it's pretty obvious what the high point of that career is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that would be Paul's Boutique, which really, for those guys, that's very, very early on. They really, it's the first record that they ever, I mean, that is probably something that deserves a qualifier because they were doing delicious stuff. They were working with Young MC, they were working with Tone Loc, but, you know, this was the really big, first project out of the chute, and they were working on these projects kind of at the same time. So I guess where I'm going with this is to look back on your career and say, and have, I think, the popular opinion be, well, the best thing you ever did was pretty much the first thing you ever did.
Now, do you find it,
it's a great question. It's a great question. I wish I would have asked that exact question. Now that you put it that way.
Now, do they like talking about Paul's Boutique?
You know, the first time around, for the 33 and the third book, they, you know, were incredibly helpful and enthusiastic, and some of that maybe is that no one had really talked about it yet. Now, for this follow-up book, you know, there was, again, I don't want to imply that they were anything less than helpful and cordial, and you know, because they definitely were. But this time around, it was more a sense, I think, of okay, the first book came out. Now we really want to set the record straight, and the record is again that it's the two of us and Yauch, and everybody else, you know, is kind of a bit player in all of this. So, you know, the second time around, it was maybe, it was a little bit more pointed, let's say. There was a definite, hey, we need to make sure that we get this cleared up kind of.
Yeah. It's crazy to think of all the stories they would have told about this album throughout the years, because if someone asked them about Paul's Boutique in 1990, they might be a bit hesitant to say, yeah, it was all of us and Yauch. They might say, exactly. It was everybody. Exactly. It's not our fault. Don't blame us. But then years after that, well, it became one of the greatest albums of all time.
Well, that's very true. And I think there's a quote somewhere. I think it came from Matt. He said, like, you know, after the record came out, he was despondent. He thought, like, I ruined these guys' careers. And it wasn't until, as you say, years and years later that it kind of has taken on the meaning that it has for us now. And everybody says it's a classic.
Right, because if I were the Dust Brothers,
that's what they were saying.
Yeah, if I were the Dust Brothers, I would be tired of talking about Paul's Boutique, and I would say, well, let's talk about Odelay now. Or let's talk about Guero now. Because for a time there was a bunch of lists and countdown shows about the greatest albums of all time, and Paul's Boutique is always up there in the top 10. And I'm sure at some point in time, the Dust Brothers just got tired of talking about how great and how genius and how fantastic it was. Because, like you said, they probably had other things to talk about too. They're like, well, we've worked on other albums too, guys, not just Paul's Boutique.
Well, my experience with artists is that an artist usually likes the thing that they did last.
Yeah, yeah.
So to have everybody want to talk about this thing that's 25 years old, and, you know, in a lot of cases, I'm sure ignore everything that has come in what I think by pretty much anyone's standards would be a pretty successful post Paul's Boutique career. Yeah, that must, it must chap them a little bit. I certainly understand that.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, they produced Paul's Boutique. And then you got to speak with Michael Diamond for the 33 and a Third book. Where did you meet up with Michael Diamond, and were you a tiny bit starstruck?
I'll say no. Part of the reason is that where I met up with him was there was a little place in Soho where we were supposed to meet, and I kept walking past this place because there was no sign out front. So by the time I got in and figured out, like, oh, this is the place, and actually went inside, I was like, you know, 20-30 minutes late, and it was more like, gee, I'm just so glad you're still here and you didn't actually leave.
Wait, you were late?
Oh, I was late. I was very late.
Oh, no, Dan! But you were late because you couldn't find it?
Well, I thought I couldn't find it, but in truth, I was there. I had the right place, but I was walking back and forth and, you know, there wasn't anything to identify this place out in front. So I was like,
but you were there on time. You just couldn't. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But well, from his perspective, I was 20-30 minutes
right.
late, and he was wondering what the hell was going on.
And if we could back up a bit, how did you set up the interview with Mike?
Let's see. It happened really late in the game, and I think it was through Jen Hall, who at least at the time was working for their management company, and she, because it was so late, because I had tried a couple of other avenues that didn't pay off, it's a good lesson. When in doubt, just go straight to management.
Okay, now what were the other avenues? The other avenues as trying to get the Beastie Boys?
Okay. You know, the usual ways that you would go, and that didn't turn up anything. And finally, I was like, hey, I'm doing this book, and I have, like, 2 weeks before I get to turn it in, and I really would like to, you know, get the band on the record about this stuff. And so it did happen, and I was actually listening back to that conversation, and it's a pretty funny conversation because the first 10 minutes of it is, you know, Mike asking me thought, wait a minute, so you talked to Matt Day. Wait a minute, how did you... So it's all his questions for me about how that happened and what did Matt say about this and that and the other. And so eventually we did, you know, I asked him some questions and we did talk about the record. But, yeah, you know, Mike, I think, is of the group. I think he's really, I don't know if he would say this himself, I think he's really the historian. He's the guy who really kind of keeps the chronology straight. So in that sense, he was probably the exact right guy to talk to. Subsequently, I ended up talking to Yalk for another book that I did, and we had made some plans to try to talk about this, the 33 and the third book, and maybe add some stuff to it, and then, of course, he gets sick, and we weren't, unfortunately, able to do that. So it was just Mike for the first book.
Now because you spoke with Yalk, who broke down Country Mike for you, right?
Yes.
Now, but that was after 33 and a third was done.
That was. It was
okay.
For a book called The Greatest Music Never Sold, which
yeah.
is about the great unreleased records.
So how was it hanging out with Yalk?
Well, we just talked on the phone, but, you know, Yalk, like Mike, was pretty much everything that I think you would expect of a Beastie Boy. Very funny,
mm-hmm.
But also very gracious and, Yalk definitely had a really good memory of the Country Mike stuff, which was great. And again, I think that was really his, I think that was his baby, as maybe Paul's Boutique was his baby too. So he definitely had a very good recollection of how that record came together.
Could we go off on a quick tangent here?
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
take us through the quick history of Country Mike?
Let's see if I can remember all this. So Country Mike, I think, came out of a movie project that the Beasties were working on with the friend Spike Jones, the guy who directed Sabotage and tons of
So
other
were they going to do a country
videos.
Movie?
I think Country Mike was just a character in the movie.
In the Sabotage movie.
Trying to remember what the movie project was. I don't remember the movie project, but I remember the Country Mike was a character, and he sort of, the movie didn't end up going anywhere, but Country Mike kind of took on a life of his own. and so they recorded this country record. And they got a couple of guys, a couple of ringers, I guess you would say, like the pedal steel player, Bucky Baxter, to come in and fill in around the edges. And as the story goes, I think, I remember Yalk telling it this way, their intent was just to press up some copies of this record for the friends and family. It was going to be a joke, but... as sometimes happens, those things find their way out into the wide world, and it becomes something else. And they did put a couple of those songs on the Sounds of Science anthology. So there are a couple of those things that have seen official release. But as for the whole project, the story was they were just going to do it as a goof, and it ended up, you know, becoming this legendary lost record.
Do you know what era or year they recorded Country Mike?
I want to say it was right around the turn of the century. I think it was...
So late 90s?
After, late 90s. I think it was after... I want to say it was after Hello Nasty, although I may be remembering that wrong. You know, these guys have always been good about building in a nice hiatus period.
Oh, yeah.
Project. So... A I can't remember if it was in the period between Ill Communication and Hello Nasty, or if it was between Hello Nasty and To the Five Boroughs. It was in one of those.
So using my deductive reasoning, and I might be totally off here, I heard that they were going to make a Sabotage movie. It never came to fruition, so possibly Country Mike was a character in Sabotage. Maybe they made the album post Ill Communication, 94, 95, 96. Maybe it sat around for a while, came out, and then I think the anthology came out in 99. And
you're right.
We got
that's
two
right.
songs from Country Mike on the anthology. But I remember when my friend Prof D said, Country Mike has an album, and I laughed, and he said, no, I have it, and it's pretty good. And I said, no, real?
Did he have the vinyl? Did he have the vinyl?
Well, Prof D is the world's foremost Beastie collector, so yes, he does have the vinyl.
Wow, nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. He probably bought one of the old copies back when it was going for quite a tidy fee on eBay.
Yeah. But it is it's a serious, for the most part, country album, in a way.
It is. And look, it always makes me smile.
Oh my gosh. And I like that Country Mike actually appears in the Alive video in full cowboy regalia on top of a horse.
He was just too good to let go of, you know, without making one final appearance, I guess.
Right. So, For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, and every time I picked this book up, I would sing the Metallica song, but I would sing it with your title. For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, Time Marches On. And I also like a very cleverly titled 66 and Two Thirds.
Yes, our imprint, which is a definite nod to the 33 and a third series, but it's 66 and two thirds, which means it's twice as metal.
And I liked your little preface in there. I don't know, what do they call that in a book? It's not the preface. Is the prologue or
the foreword?
I liked how you said that you like sequels, and they don't they don't have to be good. You like sequels.
You know, it's an admission that could be shameful for some people, but I've been looking for a way to work Caddyshack 2 into a project ever since like the summer of 1988 had finally happened. I'm so happy. Because I watched that movie maybe 20 times. And, you know, if you watch the movie and you can repeat Jackie Mason Jr.'s, all of his lines, young man, you really need to get another hobby.
Not many people shout out Caddyshack 2. But Dan does it in the foreword of his new book. So I have to ask you, did you hear the Jerry Lewis?
Yes, but I have to be clear that I only heard it over the phone. I do not own a copy, and this will kill all the potential bootleg traffic coming to my door. But I don't own a copy. As best I'm aware, there aren't any copies because my co-author, Peter Relic, did a thing which I think it's just an honorable thing. You know, he located this song, and you know, there's a million things you could do if you found a reel with a lost Beastie Boys song or two on it in some storage facility in Southern California. But Pete is a completely honorable guy, and he has some Beastie's history. He worked at Grand Royal magazine for a while, so he knows these guys, and he turned over the tapes to Mike D. And in fact, there's a photo in the book of Mike having just received it. And so while I did get a chance to hear it, and while I have to say that it, in my opinion, I got to go with what Matt Dyke says. If it would have come out, it would have been a number one hit. I agree with him.
Really?
It's pretty much, yeah.
If it came out in 89, it would have been a number one hit? Wow.
I think it would have. I think Pete's take on this in the book, I agree with what he says, which is that it was the hit that was not on Paul's Boutique, but that if it would have come out and if it would have gone to number one, their career would have been completely different. And I don't think we'd probably be having this discussion right now. I really think it's one of those what ifs where the fact that it didn't happen is the best thing that could have happened, because I think, as Pete says, it would have pigeonholed them. It would have been, here they are, that band with all the great novelty hits. And I think it's probably, it's too bad that it didn't happen, but it's probably the best thing that never happened to the Beasties.
So when Mike got the reel, did Peter already go through the process of having the tape professionally cleaned or whatever, and then...
Yes.
Oh, so he went through that whole process already.
Yeah, he had done all his due diligence, and he turned over to Mike completely, I don't know if restored is the right word, baked, I guess, is the right word, because that's what they have to do with these tapes to make sure that they're, still functional. But yeah, he'd done all that, and he gave it to him and said whatever he said in the book.
You know what? Can I read a passage from the book?
Yeah, please. That'd
so awesome. It says, in late 2013, the reel was presented to Mike D, whose response to the Jerry Lewis was, "That's just an idea we had." Upon listening, Mike blinked. And I've met Mike D before, and I can see him doing this. He blinked, and he said, "Oh, it's the whole song. It's ripe for release, Mike. Probably not this year." There you go. So I could see him saying, "Whoa, it's the thank you. It's the whole song?" Because he probably thought it was just a snippet of something.
Yeah, I suppose there's a legitimate question as to whether these guys even remember doing this, because it was early in the sessions. They moved on to other stuff. I think it's fair to say bigger and better stuff. I don't think, from talking to Mario, from talking to Mike Simpson, John King, and Matt, I don't think there was ever any real serious discussion about, "Hey, remember that song we recorded at the beginning of the sessions? How about we dust that one off?" Evidently, everybody just kind of set it aside, and it was never really a contender for inclusion on the record.
Will we hear it eventually?
Boy, there is the $64 billion question. And I guess the answer would be, as a fan, and speaking, I think, for probably 99.9% of the other fans out there, yeah, I sure hope so, because it seems like the kind of thing that, we've all been through this stuff where, we buy the new version of the record, the remastered version.
Mm-hmm.
And, they dusted off some crappy outtake and an alternate version, which is just an alternate mix that's
10
seconds shorter. Like, we've all bought those records. And to be able to buy one that actually has something of legitimate historical curiosity, I think, sure, that's what everybody wants. So I guess my hope, maybe the next best hope, would be that, they're doing their own biography, which is supposed to come out later this year or sometime next. And certainly if ever there were an opportunity to cross promote, mm-hmm. it seemed like this might be it.
Yeah. And when Yauch passed away, there was an article in Rolling Stone magazine, and I was shocked that the Beastie Boys, I think, were recording the previous November. Just, they were hanging out, they were ordering takeout, and they were recording songs. So I would love to hear stuff from those sessions, even if they're not complete songs. But I don't know if the Beastie Boys do that. Are they going to put out a 30-second idea? I don't know.
You know, that's a great question, and I think the gut instinct would be, I have to say, those guys seem to me like they have a lot of integrity. And mm-hmm. it's a funny thing, you know, when you think about where we started this discussion in 85 and 86, that right. you would get to this place almost 30 years later where it'd say, you know, yeah, the Beastie Boys are really one of the bands out there that have integrity. They wouldn't do something just to cash in. But I think that's true. And I think that might preclude the release of stuff like what you're talking about, especially if they thought, you know, that there was any danger of sullying Yauch's memory. I don't think they would do that.
Yep.
So where that leaves a thing like the Jerry Lewis, that I wish I knew.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll find out one day. I was hoping you would say, you know what, Jim? This podcast is sort of under the radar. I'm going to send you the MP3 of the Jerry Lewis, and you can play it on the Brouhaha. And this would probably be the highest rated episode of the Brouhaha ever. It still could be, though.
If I had it.
All right.
I would make that opportunity available, because there's nothing I'd like better than to make this the highest rated.
You know, and it might be. So in line.
But that would put the capper on it.
I know. So in line with the Jerry Lewis, when I was reading your first book, Max Perlick had a footnote, and he was saying that the Dust Brothers really wanted to have that big single, and they had an instrumental using Wilson Pickett's Engine Number 9. Now, yeah. Wilson Pickett's, I guess there was some, I don't know if he was misremembering things, because in your latest book, you talk about KMD, and on Walk on the Wild Side, that's where they use Engine Number 9 from Wilson Pickett.
And actually, even though I think Max's memory was of that song instead of an outtake, I'm really glad that he mentioned that, because had he not mentioned that song that had that sample, I would have never thought to ask again this time around, hey, what about that song with the Engine Number 9? And that's what led me to KMD and the guys who actually did use that sample. And what a great story those guys are.
So for those that don't know, on For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, at the end of the book, there's a section called Boutique Bouillabaisse, and there's just a bunch of different little stories, and one of those stories is about, is it just a rapper, KMD?
It's actually the rapper,
it's a group?
KMD, and also the rapper and the group, KMD, the plural would be K, and then his DJ Shock.
Okay. And KM, that's Known Master of Devastation?
Yep.
Okay. And I never heard the story before. The Beastie Boys listened to the song called Walk on the Wild Side, and they were just fascinated by the distorted lyrics, so fascinated that they went on to use distorted lyrics in Check Your Head, Ill Communication, and then you could even say they used distorted lyrics on Hot Sauce Committee Part 2. So they fell in love with that style. Well, they called it the bullshit mic, which you can see in the Sure Shot video. But who knew that that was inspired from KMD, a new revelation that I read in For Whom the Cowbell Tolls?
I don't think anybody knew, including me, and I think the only guys who knew were the Beasties and the Dust Brothers, and then Kay and Shock themselves. I think it was a pretty small circle of people, and those guys never put out a record, so, you know, the story kind of went under the radar all those years, but it was Max Perlick mentioning that sample that really opened the door to...
Yeah, it's wild, because when I read the book, I went back and listened to Engine Number 9 from Wilson Pickett, and I was trying to envision what the Dust Brothers and the Beastie Boys would do on that, and then years later, when I heard that there was an unreleased song from the Paul's Boutique session, I thought it was that Engine Number 9 song, and in reality, it was the Jerry Lewis. And then I get your book, and I read about KMD, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's where the Engine Number 9 sample comes in. Can we play a quick snippet of that song right now?
Oh, I'd love to. That'd be fantastic.
Okay, so let's do that right now.
Chosen, those who ain't with it, just but oppose and stand the hell still. As I walk on, you've been notified. Now it's time to step strong. I got a DJ that cuts like a madman. Kind of brother that don't give a goddamn. RMS is his abbreviated title, but you call him Rockmaster Shock, the turntable idol. A disc jockey, jockey of the disc. Leading and proceeding to find breaks that sound like this. Go, go, swing. Don't mean a thing. That is, of course, unless I get to bring out all in my heart. Fight up to the jump start of the party until I depart. To come again, this time even harder. It's a new beginning, the dawning, the startup. Drama that I'm on right and direct. And it'll be the same one you choose to select. So, let the title be amplified. In all, swallow your pride. Take a walk on the wild side.
There you go, Walk on the Wild Side from KMD, a little taste of that. I found that on the internet. I don't have a complete version of that. Do you by chance have a complete version of that?
I don't have the complete version of that, but I think the version that you're referencing is the version that they made available to the website egotrip.com, and they did a sampler, I think, of... I found samples of, I believe, four or five of the tracks that they recorded around this time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you listen to this stuff, just think, wow, of all the what-ifs, and we've talked about several so far, but of all the what-ifs, the one that I really think about the most is, what if this record would have come out in 89 or 90? On Delicious Vinyl or on any number of other labels, you know, I think we would be talking about these guys right up there with De La Soul, with KRS-One.
It's so good.
It's
so good.
It is.
And when you hear it, you just see the light bulbs going off in the Beastie Boys' heads. And I love in your book, too, how Yauch wanted to know everything about it. About the rhyme flow, about how it was recorded, how did they get that sound.
That just seems to be the kind of guy he was.
Yep.
Of the three guys, he seems to be the guy who really had his ear out the most for what was happening, and then brought that back in, and it's pretty easy to imagine him hearing that stuff and saying, okay, let's figure out a way to make some of this work for us.
And then, if I can make another connection in your book, you talk about the Check Your Head period, where the Beastie Boys are then asked to turn a hit in to the record label. They didn't want to do that from Paul's Boutique. They learned their lesson. So this time around, they're like, you know what? We better make that hit. They went back and they made So What You Want, obviously inspired by Walk on the Wild Side from KMD. Full circle. You kids got to read Dan Leroy's writing and you'll get all this.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's a very wonderful compliment to receive. And remember, kids, we serve the middle-aged and the elderly, too. Never too late to get that knowledge. 66 and two-thirds is not an ageist outfit by any stretch of the imagination.
But would you agree with me that they wanted to turn in the hit for Check Your Head so they didn't have a relapse of what happened with Paul's Boutique?
I do agree, and I was actually talking to the A&R man who told that story, Tim Devine, who is a guy who signed Bonnie Raitt to Capitol and then saw her go on to sell 13, 14 million records and win a ton of Grammys, and he's worked with all manner of heavy hitters in the music business, and I was very fortunate to be able to talk to him, and you know, he told that story, and I think it's a very telling thing at a couple of levels. One is that, you know, as you described, that they definitely had learned their lesson, but I also think it shows, you know, these guys, for all the reputation that they had for being, you know, uncompromising and stick to your guns and never give up, never give in. You know, when it really counted, and I think this might have been the most critical moment in their career, when it really counted, they were smart. And they were willing to, I don't think anyone would say that So What You Want is a compromise or that they sold anything out, or I don't think that would ever occur to anyone who listened to Check Your Head, but it speaks to something good about those guys, I think, that they you know, they'd grown up at that point, and they knew when it was the right time to try to meet in the middle, and I don't know if it's actually in the middle. I think it's still more on the Beasties end.
Yep, I agree. Continuum.
But yeah, it's a great story and one that I hadn't heard. And Tim Devine was a guy who inherited these guys from the previous A&R man, Tim Carr. And then Tim Devine really saw them through the kind of golden era that you were talking about. A little bit earlier.
92 through 95. So, Dan, yeah, we're an hour deep into this episode. I'm going to let you go soon, but let's start wrapping it up. I have a list of notes here that I'd love to talk about. So if we could hit on these quickly.
Do it.
Because you're a father of three, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. You can read that in the foreword of 33 and a third. So, in 33 and a third, you mention Hayes' original cover for Paul's Boutique. You also put the website. As soon as I read the book, I went to the website. It wasn't there. So what does the original cover for Paul's Boutique look like?
It looks a lot like some of the interior shots, the swimming pool stuff. But then it has... And I wish I could do a good job of describing this logo to you. It's a beautiful logo.
Do you have a picture of it?
I don't know if I still have the picture. You know what? I will look and see if I've got that. I remember seeing it on his site some time ago, and I don't know if I have it anymore. But it's a really cool logo, which he and Yauch both worked on. They kind of burned these letters in a very... long and I guess expensive process. And, you know, he was kind of bummed out that it didn't end up making the cover, of course.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to argue with what they came up with because it's become such a part of the Paul's Boutique legend. But
Hayes got his due on Check Your Head.
It is true. He went on to do Check Your Head, and that became an equally iconic thing. So maybe it was just the right thing for the right project, and it worked out the way it was supposed to.
Yeah, so if Hayes is listening, you created my favorite Beastie Boys font. So keep your head up high. All right.
There you go.
In 33 and a third, you talk about Yauch wanting to create an A-gun, and they actually got some sketches from Hasbro. How far did the egg gun go? Do you know anything about that?
This is one of those things where the one guy, I believe, who seemed to have the clearest memory of it was Mike Simpson. But I don't know if that's an apocryphal story or not. I it's one of those stories that you want to be true so badly.
Right.
But nobody, I should be clear, nobody had any sketches. When I talked to Mike about it, he kind of played the whole thing off, talking about it, how good it would have been for egg farmers and stuff. And it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that it ever got along the development stage, but I've never seen any evidence that it was more than just an idea.
So you could not buy an egg gun at Toys R Us? Or Children's
Badly,
Palace
no.
in 1989.
Oh, Children's Palace.
I had to shout that out because that's where I would have gotten my A gun in 1989, Children's Palace. There you go.
I would have gone to Children's Palace to get my A gun in 1989, even though it would have been a bit of a trek because I went there as a kid, and that was the toy store to end all.
Oh, yeah.
With Virginia.
Yep. Now, there was a Children's Palace in Pittsburgh that actually had a water slide behind it.
So, I think I remember that one, although I think we went to, how many were there?
I don't know. I think it was a chain, but mine was on McKnight Road. Okay. Continuing on, Barnyard Noises on the Sounds of Science. I forget which Dust Brother says it. He says a lot of people
think it was Mike.
Mike
yeah.
thinks, he says a lot of people think it's a cow in a can, but it's actually a famous person's voice warped in a way where you would never guess which famous person it was. On the brouhaha, can you tell us what famous person it was?
I wish.
Or did he tell you that in confidence?
He did not actually even tell me in confidence. When pressed, he refused to divulge the identity of said famous person, and no amount of entreaties were sufficient to persuade him to give up that information. And I'm very sorry to have to admit that on the brouhaha or really anywhere.
Quick thoughts on Mike D's mixtape etiquette. After reading that, I just shook my head. I'm like, come on, Mike. You really? End a song in the middle and you have to flip over the tape and continue it? Horrible mixtape etiquette.
I got to say that when it comes to mixtape etiquette, I'm much more of the same mind as Jeremy Shatton, who was considerate enough to give me that tape. And my reaction was the same thing. You know, I was one of those guys who used to slave over the cassette deck. And maybe the song, you know, however it reads in the book, I'm describing myself for sure, because I was a conscientious mixtaper. And to have that kind of blatant disregard just thrown in your face, it was shocking, Jim. I got to tell you, it was shocking. Maybe not shocking when you think that, you know, it was a Beastie Boy that did it, but still.
Yeah, because if you have a minute 30 left, I had a collection of songs that I could squeeze into that minute 30. And I would never think of cutting off a song. Once again, you can read about that in For Whom the Cowbell Tolls. This is in the boutique bouillabaisse section. And then finally, well, I have one more question after this, but I loved the little portion on Lloyd Lindsey Young, a New York weatherman who the Beastie Boys brought into the studio, and they wanted him to say that famous line, "It's a trip. It's got a funky beat, and I can bug out to it." Wow. Now, was that your idea to track him down?
Yes, it was my idea, and I actually wanted to get him for the 33 and a third book. I don't remember where he was working at the time, but I think I just ran out of time, and it never came to pass. So for this edition, early on, even before I knew that I was going to do some of the other things I did, a particular mission, don't let me say Ben Dead, was to track down Lloyd Lindsey Young, because I wanted him in this book. And I'm so happy that he ended up in there and got to tell his part of Beastie history.
Do you know, for years, I couldn't figure, I was like, where did they get that sample? Where did they get it? And it wasn't a sample. They actually brought him in for a recording session.
See, that's what you just got to love about these guys, especially at the time. Like, I don't think there was any other group on earth who would have sought out a guy that they used to see doing the weather on 11 o'clock news and bring him into the studio just to read a single line. I mean, that's, of all the things that you gotta love about the Beastie, that's one that I think I love the most, that they would have, number one, that they would have thought of it. Number two, that they would have gotten a record company most likely to pay for it. And number three, that it would have ended up on the record and become the little iconic moment that it became.
And then
it would be sampled, again, because it became such a moment.
Well, speaking of mixtapes, I put that on plenty of mixtapes. I would just put that between songs. And then...
Yeah.
Belle Biv DeVoe uses a sample, and in the book, Lloyd Lindsey Young calls those guys dirty rascals for using his voice on a BBD song.
He was not happy. He was not happy. He had, a very sunny disposition, which darkened only when he started talking about BBD. Yeah, he did not like their use of his dulcet tones at all.
Now, his signature was the hello. Hello! Which Ad-Rock used in Hello, Brooklyn, right?
Yep, that is right.
So
he actually gets a couple of shout-outs on the record.
Yeah, so once again, stuff I didn't know until I read your books, plural. Final question before you go, Dan. And by the way, thank you for joining us tonight. This was fantastic. I feel like we could have talked for 10 hours. Final question before you go.
I feel the same way.
Well, you know, you can come on again. It's not like you just have to be on one episode of the Brouhaha. One question, though, before you go. What is your favorite Beastie Boys album?
This is a tough call because the first three records are so great in so many ways, and they were, kind of important at different times, as I'm sure is true with everybody. I have to say, though, that Paul's Boutique still, by a whisker, over License to Ill and Check Your Head. It's very tough for me to separate them. But I still go back to listening to Shake Your Rump and thinking, where did they get all of these sounds? And I got to say, even today, now that I've listened to it thousands of times, and I know exactly where they got every single one of the sounds, and I can identify the sources of all of them, I still feel the same way. about it. And to me, that's what has to make it the winner, because any piece of music that you can dissect as much as that one's been dissected and still kind of have the same effect as the first time you heard it, that's a great record. That's a great album.
Well put. You must be a writer or something.
Every now and then.
So, Dan, thank you a million for joining us. For those listening right now, go out and get Paul's Boutique 33 and a third, part of the Continuum series, and its sequel, For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, 25 years of Paul's Boutique, written by Dan A. Leroy.
And Peter Relic. Hey. I want to shout out to my co-author. And, Jim, it's been a total pleasure. And I would be glad to do this again anytime. So, like it says in the book, I am into sequels, and this is well worth the sequel.
Perfect. Let's end it like that. So, for Dan Leroy, my name is Jim Shear, and we will see yins later.
Yo, we gonna end it on a 1, 2, 3 though. Are you ready? 1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Guarantee we bring the brouhaha.
Get your brouhaha.
Young Leroy.